18. My father led me through a maze of dimly lit corridors, then onto a turbo elevator. It whisked us upward to the base's top level, and the doors opened onto the observation deck. I now noticed that the transparent dome overhead was the exact same size as the domed ceiling down in the Thunderdome, and it offered the exact same view. I glanced around until I located the camera array suspended from the dome's armored frame, which captured the 360-degree view of the surrounding landscape in high definition and projected it onto the Thunderdome's concrete ceiling, deep beneath the moon's rocky mantle. Without pausing to admire the view, my father crossed to the other side of the observation deck to another elevator door. Unlike the other doors on the base, this one failed to open automatically when he approached it. Instead, he flipped open a panel beside it to reveal a numeric keypad and punched in a long code from memory. The doors swished open, and we stepped inside. There was a single button with a down arrow on it that lit up when my father pressed it. The elevator carried us downward, dropping us so fast I thought my feet might lift up off the floor for a moment. When the car opened, we stepped out into a narrow service tunnel lined with wires and metal tubing. I followed my father down its length, nearly sprinting to keep up. It was a very long tunnel with a steep downward grade. When we finally reached the other end, my father opened a circular hatch in the ceiling with yet another security code. After a short climb up a metal ladder, we emerged into a large circular room with a clear domed ceiling. It provided a stunning view of the surrounding crater and of the armored sphere that was Moonbase Alpha, visible off to our right. A giant armored orb nestled into the adjacent goblet-shaped crater high above us, just beyond the lip of the larger bowl-shaped Daedalus crater in which we now stood. "Welcome to Daedalus Observatory," my father said. "Sorry about all the dust and trash. The cleaning drones never come down here, obviously. They closed the observatory down over 2 decades ago and made the whole place off-limits." I spent a moment gazing out at the barren lunar surface, which stretched to the black horizon in all directions. The sight suddenly drove home the fantastic isolation of the place. It was no wonder my father and his friends behaved a bit strangely. The years of solitude they'd had to endure up here probably would have driven a lot of people nuts. "You said this place was off-limits?" "It was," he said. "It is. But I figured out how to get the power and life support systems in here back online without alerting anyone back on Earth. And I left all of the hidden microphones and cameras in here disabled. So this is one of the few places in the entire base where the EDA can't monitor or record me." He leaned toward a small microphone stock protruding from a nearby security console and then spoke into it loudly. "Open the pod bay doors, Hal," he recited. I said, "Please open the pod bay doors, Hal." He grinned at me. "See? Sweet, sweet privacy." "Right, we wouldn't want the cigarette-smoking man to eavesdrop on us," I muttered. But he ignored the remark. "Here," he said, reaching over to flip a bank of switches, flooding the dim space with flickering fluorescent light. "This is what I wanted to show you." The other side of the control room was a chaotic, cluttered mess. Handwritten notes, diagrams, drawings, and computer printouts were taped up everywhere and stacked on every available surface. It looked like the lair of a homicide detective on some TV show, one who had spent decades tracking a serial killer no one else believed existed. I crossed the room and walked through the paper jungle my father had created, studying his notes and printouts. "I know how all this stuff must look," he said, as if he'd read my mind. "Like Russell Crowe's garage in A Beautiful Mind, right?" "I was thinking it looked more like a supervillain's lair," I said. I started punching random buttons on the console in front of me. "Which one of these is the self-destruct?" "The first one you pressed, actually," he said, pointing to an unlabeled red button. I believed him for a split second, long enough for my eyes to widen in panic. "Yes!" he said, grinning. "Got you, kid." "Fine, you got me," I said. "You did all this yourself?" He nodded. "I've never shared any of this with either Shin or Graham," he said. Shin wouldn't take any of it seriously, he said. And Graham... Well, Graham doesn't have a very skeptical way of thinking, and I wanted to approach this scientifically. He locked eyes with me. But from what you said up in the mess hall before, I was sure you didn't want to hear any of this. I shook my head. I've been asking myself the same questions you and Graham mentioned. I just didn't think learning the answers could make any difference now. I locked eyes with him. Tell me, I said. He nodded and took a deep breath. You know who Finn Arbogast is, he said. It wasn't a question, but I nodded. The fake founder of Chaos Terrain, I said, recalling my brief meeting with the man that morning at Crystal Palace, a lifetime ago. What about him? I was his primary military consultant when he and the Chaos Terrain team were developing Terra Firma and Armada, as well as all of the early mission packs, he said, and I thought I detected a tinge of pride in his voice. I always dreamed of making video games for a living when I grew up, so you can imagine how I felt when I got the chance to help design the video games that might save the world. Arbogast and I collaborated for several months. Not in person, but we video conferenced several times a week. It was his job to create the video games that would train the world's population how to fight off the Europans. So his training simulations had to be able to simulate their ships, weapons, maneuvers, and tactics, all with a very high degree of accuracy. To accomplish that, they gave Arbogast unrestricted access to all of the EDA's data on the Europans, everything we'd learned about them since we made first contact. He sighed heavily. And I managed to access some of that classified data. How? I asked. When you were stuck up here and he was back on Earth. He linked his computer network to ours, my father said, so that he could share new builds of Terra Firma and Armada with us as soon as they were ready for testing. That allowed me to gain access to his research files on the Europans, which contained a lot of the top secret data about our interactions with them over the years, and everything I learned from them confirmed the theory I'd already been forming for almost a decade. I nodded, trying to hide how nervous he was making me. Lay it on me, I said. Okay, he said. Here goes. He took a deep breath. Ever since we made first contact with them, the aliens have been intercepting our movies and television broadcasts. Then they edit clips from them together and transmit them back to us, once a year, just prior to the Jovian opposition, he told me. But only a handful of people have ever been allowed to see the transmissions. He motioned to the screen. Now I need you to see them too. A barrage of these alien-edited video clips began to appear on the screen, and every last one of them depicted some form of human conflict. I glimpsed a lot of World War II newsreel footage, intercut with photos and video of the dozens of other large-scale military conflicts that had occurred in the following decades. But these images of real-life war were intercut with scenes from a lot of old war movies and television series. It almost seemed as if the Europans were unable to differentiate between reality and fiction. Either that, or they were intercutting the two on purpose in an effort to make some kind of point. Even weirder, I also began to spot brief scenes taken from dozens of science fiction films, all of them featuring hostile alien invaders of some kind. In the space of just a few seconds, I spotted shots from various films in the Trek and Wars franchises, mixed with shots from the various versions of War of the Worlds, The Day the Earth Stood Still, V, and even, God help us, Battlefield Earth. Nothing from the friendly alien movie genre, though. Not so much a single glimpse of E.T., Starman, Earth to Echo, or ALF. Look at these transmissions, he said, as the barrage of clips continued to flash on the screen, showing a grotesque menagerie of extraterrestrial invaders plucked from the entire history of science fiction films. Aliens, predators, triffids, transformers, you name it. These images, and the way in which they're arranged. I think it's some kind of a message, son, he said. An intentionally cryptic one. It's like they're holding up a mirror so that we can see ourselves from their perspective. The rapid montage of unsettling imagery flashing on the screen suddenly segued into a series of 2- and 3-second long clips from summer blockbusters like Independence Day, Armageddon, and Deep Impact, most of them from scenes that depicted all of humanity uniting as one species to save itself and its home from a deadly comet, a rogue asteroid, or from a wide variety of hostile alien invaders. I think the Europans have been studying us and our popular culture since before we even made first contact with them, my father said, raking his hands through his hair. I think they watched all of the science fiction films and television shows we've made that depict an alien invasion of our planet, and they realized it was one of our species' worst nightmares. So they set about making it happen. They proceeded to stage an alien invasion just like the ones we'd always imagined. The kind depicted in our fiction, complete with giant motherships, starship dogfights, killer robots, all of it. My father stared at me, waiting for me to say something, but I was momentarily speechless. I could only continue to stare at the screen where the images kept coming. I spotted stills from the reboots of The Thing, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and War of the Worlds, and then a clip from an older film, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers. I knew for certain these transmissions were intended to be some sort of message when I heard this, he said, tapping his QCOM. Each of these bursts of images ends with a series of 5 tones. It was the opening of Wild Signals from John Williams' score for Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The 5 tones the government has their keyboardists start off with when they play that epic game of Simon with the aliens at the end of the movie. La 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 bum bum. The tones sounded as if they were coming from an old touch-tone push-button telephone handset. They began to play very quickly on a repeating loop. Then my father muted the audio and turned to study my reaction. But hearing those 5 notes from Close Encounters had momentarily thrown me off balance. I'd never liked that film, probably because of how easy it was for the main character, Roy Neary, to, spoiler alert, leave his family at the very end of the film. It hit a little too close to home. I stared at the images. I listened to the tones. I waited for him to continue. Okay, he said, inching forward. First, just think about the chronology of events. Think about how our first contact with them went down. The Europans orchestrated this entire conflict. They lured and manipulated us into it. He narrowed his eyes. Why else would they slap a giant swastika on the surface of Europa? It was a trap, and we walked right into it, just like Admiral fucking Akbar. Under other circumstances, this might have made me laugh, but not then. So, he went on, humanity discovers this threatening message from an obviously non-human intelligence, placed in a spot where they knew humans would find it when our technology advanced to the stage where we were capable of sending probes to our outer solar system, sort of like the monolith buried on the moon in 2001. I nodded, not in agreement, but just to indicate I understood the reference. I'm sure I would have mentioned that I'd read his copy of The Sentinel, the short story by Arthur C. Clarke that served as the initial inspiration for 2001's Artifact Left Behind by Ancient Aliens storyline. But internally, I was wondering if my father was experiencing confirmation bias, or observational selection bias, or one of those other biases I'd learned about in my AP psychology class. Maybe he was seeing patterns where none really existed. Then again, maybe not. The Europans must have known we wouldn't be able to resist sending a probe down to investigate its origin. And the moment we did, they suddenly declared war and their intention to kill off our entire species. According to the official story, the aliens never gave us a chance to explain our actions or negotiate with them. But they didn't kill us off right away, even though they clearly had the technological means of doing so. No, instead of attacking us, they lured us into some sort of weird arms race. Then they gradually let us close the technological gap between us and them over a 42-year period. And then, this year, they finally decide to invade. Why? Their behavior doesn't make any sense. Unless they're testing us. It's the only logical explanation. We're not talking about Vulcans here, I reminded him. You can't impose human logic on alien behavior, right? Why should anything they do make sense to us? Their culture and motives might be, you know, beyond our human understanding. My father shook his head. This human understands enough to know when he's being messed with, he said. These aliens have coaxed and manipulated us into this exact position for a reason. Maybe to elicit a reaction, or to put us in specific kinds of circumstances to see how we'll react to them, collectively, as a species. As a test? He nodded. Then he sat down abruptly without saying another word, like an attorney who had finished delivering his closing argument to a jury, and stared at me, apparently waiting for me to respond, his eyes darting back and forth feverishly, hanging on my reaction. What is it you think they're testing us on? To see how terrified they can make us? To see how difficult we are to kill or enslave? I don't know, son, he said, his voice still calm and even despite his expression. Maybe they wanted to see how our species would handle itself during an encounter with another intelligent species. A potentially hostile one? That's one of the classic tropes of science fiction. Aliens are always showing up to put humanity on trial. The day the Earth stood still, stranger in a strange land, have spacesuit will travel, and a bunch of different Star Trek episodes. The Europans might have a million different motives. On the 80s reboot of The Twilight Zone, there was this one episode called A Small Talent for War. I raised my hand to cut him off. But this isn't science fiction, General, I said, feeling as if I were the adult in this conversation, while he had assumed the role of the starry-eyed teenager who won't listen to reason. This isn't some Twilight Zone episode. It's real life, remember? Life imitates art, he said. And maybe these particular aliens do, too. He smiled at me. Does any of this feel like something that could happen in real life to you? Or do events seem to be unfolding the way they would in a story or a movie, perfectly timed for dramatic effect? He picked up a large whiteboard resting against a nearby console and tilted it toward me so that I could see the two hastily drawn diagrams on it. He'd drawn a picture of the Death Star from Star Wars on the left side and a sketch of the disruptor dodecahedron on the right. Both drawings were surrounded by arrows and notes that appeared to draw a comparison between the two, but it was hard to be sure because I couldn't read my father's handwriting to save my life. Take the disruptor, for example, he said. Why is it so difficult to destroy when we have no problem plowing through their other drones? Why not make all of their drones that hard to destroy? Because the disruptor is a level boss, that's why. He pointed to the whiteboard. The disruptor is their version of the Death Star. It's a huge, nearly indestructible doomsday weapon, but it has a small Achilles heel that will allow us to destroy it. He locked eyes with me. It's like they designed it that way, so that at least one pilot has to sacrifice themselves to destroy it. The shields only drop for a few seconds, just long enough for two perfectly timed core detonations to go off. Why would they engineer it that way unless it was on purpose? I nodded. I wondered the same thing, I confessed. No weapons designer or engineer would build something with such an arbitrary weakness, he said. The disruptor is more like something a video game developer would come up with to create a big challenge at the end of a level, a boss that requires a huge sacrifice to destroy, and then they send one, just one, to attack this base instead of sending it straight to Earth. Why? Because they wanted us to see how it worked. Then they let us destroy it. Maybe that was part of their test, to find out if humans are willing to make a heroic sacrifice to save their comrades, to see if our species actually behaves the way we portray ourselves in our books and movies and games. He stood back up and began to pace, faster and faster. They could be testing us to see if humanity lacks the courage of its convictions. Are we as selfless and noble as we think we are? But how would the aliens even know about Vance's heroic sacrifice, I asked, or about anything that was going on within the EDA's ranks during those battles? He bit his lower lip. Then he held up his QCOM. Think about it. Where did this QCOM tech come from? I shook my head, not wanting to believe it, but he nodded in disagreement. The Europans invented this technology, and we barely even understand how it works, he said. For all we know, they're using these to eavesdrop on us right now. He rubbed his temples, wincing. I mean, do you think it was a coincidence that of all the EDA sites around the world they could have attacked this morning, they chose the one where we just relocated all of our elite recruit candidates? He fell silent and stared at me. My head was spinning. I sat down in one of the leather chairs bolted to the floor. Why are you telling me all this? I asked. He frowned, looking disappointed that I needed to ask. Because you're my son, he said. Maybe I just want to get your opinion. On what, General? On what you think we should do, he said. Do we ignore everything about the Europans' actions that don't add up and let the EDA launch their doomsday weapon at them? Try to commit genocide against the first intelligent species we've ever contacted? But they're coming here to commit genocide against us, I shouted. We have no choice but to defend ourselves. I believe we do, son. I think that's what they're doing, presenting us with a choice. We can try to destroy them, thereby ensuring that they destroy us, he said. Or we can take a gamble based on our deductions and our moral reasoning and try to stop the icebreaker. But then, won't we just be allowing them to wipe us out when they arrive? If they wanted to exterminate humanity, they could have done it decades ago, he said. They had the technological capability to wipe us out the day we made first contact with them. The illusion that we can defeat them in this war is just that, an illusion. It always has been. I didn't respond. He took me by the shoulders. No one else knows all of this. No one else could read these tea leaves like you and me, Zach. I feel like there must be a reason the two of us are here right now. We're in a position to decide the fate of humanity. He smiled. Maybe it's destiny. I stared into his eyes. He was telling me the truth, or what he believed to be the truth. There was no doubt in my mind of that. It's impossible to have a poker face with someone who has the same face as you. This is why you didn't participate in that first icebreaker mission, wasn't it? I asked. The Admiral benched you, didn't he? He thought you might try to sabotage it. He nodded. He knows me well, he said. We were friends a long time. You shared this theory with Admiral Vance, I said, and he didn't buy it? Archie is a good man. Fearless, honorable. But the guy doesn't have much of an imagination, he said. And he doesn't know shit about common tropes in science fiction, he grinned. Take his call sign, Viper. He borrowed that from Tom Skerritt's character in Top Gun, his all-time favorite movie. He hates science fiction. I could never get him to watch Trek, Wars, Firefly, or BSG. He shook his head. The bastard even refused to watch E.T. Who doesn't love E.T., I ask you?
Yeah, the man obviously can't be trusted, I muttered.
My father frowned at my sarcasm. That's not what I meant, he said. Archie is a fighter at heart. He believes we can beat them, despite their superior technology, because evolution has better equipped us for warfare. He shook his head. I'm a gamer, Zach, like you. When I find myself confronted with a puzzle, I can't help but try to solve it. He began to pace back and forth in front of me again. I want to find out what the Europans really are. What's really down there under all that ice? He looked up through the dome at the bright band of stars overhead. I want to know the truth. I want to reach the end of the game. He turned to lock eyes with me once again. And I want to save the world, if I can.
How?
I'm not sure, he said. But I'm going to try if I get the opportunity. He looked at the floor. And I wanted to explain myself to you first, so you'll understand any actions I may be forced to take. He shrugged. Maybe you can explain them to your mother if I don't get the chance. He trailed off. I was too frightened of what he might say to ask him to elaborate. When it became clear to him that I wasn't going to say anything more, my father reached out and pressed his hand to the scanner beside the exit. The door hissed open. It's a lot to process, he said. I'll give you some privacy to think it all through. He took a step forward, as if to hug me, but something in my eyes made him change his mind. He smiled and stepped back. I'm going to head back down to the Thunderdome and run a final systems check on each of the control pods, he said. Meet me there whenever you're ready, okay? I nodded, but remained silent. He gave me another forced smile, then disappeared through the exit. Once he was gone, I sat there alone in the darkened Daedalus Observatory control room, at the center of the giant electronic ear that humanity had constructed to try to communicate with its enemy, thinking about everything my father had just told me. What if he was right about this? Just like he'd been right all those years ago, when he scribbled down his theory about the Earth Defense Alliance in that old notebook of his. That theory of his had seemed ridiculous at first, too. I let the possibility linger in my thoughts for a moment. Then, I cast one last glance up through the dome at the starry dynamo stretched out over my head, taking it all in. Then I turned and hurried out the exit, fleeing the solitude of the Daedalus Observatory as quickly as I could. There wasn't much time left. I didn't feel like spending any more of it alone.